privilege and a joy to be with you today and to be engaged in worship with our Lord. Thankful to see some faces that I haven't seen in quite some time. Rejoiced to be in worship with you and fellowship with you again. Something I intentionally did not say but during prayer requests, but it is something we need to be in prayer for. I've had an observation recently, and this is in no way tied to the sermon this morning. I just feel the need to say it. We live in a time and in a culture where, whether we realize or not, things rub off on us, you know, a whole lot more than we give them credit for. And I live, at least professionally, in a very, very strange environment. I work for all of you. I work for the United States government. It's a weird place sometimes. Things get exaggerated that don't look like they look anywhere else. I've never understood how this particular month we're in, things that I truly think need to happen, they say, well, we can't buy that, we're broke. But before the end of the month, they want me to spend all this money on training or travel or these other things that they haven't spent yet. And I said, wait a minute, I want to use that money over here for this thing we really need. Well, we can't spend it there, it doesn't work. We're broke. But you got to spend this over here, we're going to lose it. I still don't understand that. If you work in the government, you know what I'm talking about. So I live in an exaggerated world professionally every day. Right now, my wife, after 14 years, is doing an extended substitute run at Bledsoe County for a teacher that's on maternity leave. So I've heard through her a lot more firsthand accounts of what's happening in schools right now than normal. And she said, after 14 years, this would be the time that I'd go back and be a long-term substitute. I see things every day that some I agree with, some I don't. My wife is seeing things happen at school. Some she agrees with, some she doesn't. You watch the news, you're going to see things that some you agree with, some you don't. You're going to have friends that have a different opinion than you do. Some you agree with, and some you don't. It's very easy. I can say this from experience, as one who lives in an exaggerated world professionally, it's very easy to let that rub off on you one way or the other. Either you can start being the kind of thing that you disagree with, just go along to get along, or you can let it push you to the point where you can become bitter, angry, you know, very, you know, confrontational. And friends, the Lord has required of us to be faithful, to be obedient, to be servants, no matter the situation we're in. So in this very exaggerated time that we live in, I encourage all of you, and myself too, let us walk as the light of this world. Let us walk as the disciples of Christ, so that when others see us, they don't see people that are being affected by the world. They see people who, in the very best way that they can, as God gives us grace, are affecting the world in which we live. I want to be a force and a factor in my little world for good things, for positive things, not to be of the very same weak and beggarly elements this old world has. So I encourage all of you, don't let this old world rub off on you. Don't let it get you in mindsets that you don't need to have. And let us all walk together, and not just this morning, but in the days to come, in the fellowship and the fertile fields of the gospel. This morning, Lord being our helper, I want to get lost with you for a little while. I freely confess that I know very little about what I'm about to talk about. Preachers say the strangest things I know when we're in the pulpit. In Isaiah 55, verses 8 and 9, you'll find out very quickly how we're about to get lost. Verse 8, the Lord has this to say. He says, my thoughts are not your thoughts, and my ways are not your ways. Verse 9 says, for as high as heaven is above the earth, so high are my ways above yours and my thoughts and your thoughts. Here we find a very interesting piece of ground that we could go in a number of different directions with, but let's consider, first of all, what the Lord is here telling us through Isaiah. I often misquoted this, at least verse 8, and I know a lot of the people do. A lot of times you'll hear it quoted this way, my ways are not your ways, my thoughts are not your thoughts. And actually, he says, my thoughts are not your thoughts, and my ways are not your ways. You say, well, is the order that important? Actually, it is. Because if you consider the difference between a thought and a thought is a process that you go through. It's how you determine, you know, what you think about something. It's how you mentally reason how you're going to apply something. And then your ways are your behavior. It's your walk. And it's the way way in which you go. Most of us, unless we're just fly-by-the-seat-of-our-pants kind of people, we try to think about something before we do something, right? It's okay, I said try. We try to think about it before we do it. Now, I know sometimes we talk before we think about it, and it gets us in trouble. Sometimes we do before we consider the ramifications of it, and it gets us in trouble. But we try to think about something before we do it. If you allow me to put this in my own words, the Lord is here saying, my motivation is not your motivation. And my action is not the same as your action. In other words, the Lord isn't just higher than we are in what He does. He's higher than we are in why He does it, the motivation behind it. You know, we can do a number of different things, and we can do the wrong thing and be motivated correctly, and we can do the right thing and be motivated incorrectly. You know, the Pharisees were motivated to do what the law commanded them to do. They were motivated to keep the sacrifices, to keep the Passover, to do all the things that Moses and the law commanded. Their motivation, though, was self-glory. Their motivation was to be seen of men. They were motivated to pray. But what motivated them? They were motivated to stand on the street corner so they would be seen of men and have praise of men. Now, friends, doing what God commanded is right. Praying is right. But the motivation there was wrong. Now, there's other people that are sincere. They are sincere and they're well-meaning and well-intentioned, and their motivation is good. But even though the motivation is good, the action that follows it must be right as well. You know, there's a lot of people in this world, and I'm not trying to beat up anybody. I just want to make a point as an example. There are a lot of people in this world who really think that they need to spend the money or put in the time or actually do the travel to go somewhere to get the gospel to somebody so that they can hear the gospel, rejoice in it, and go to heaven. They are truly motivated by love and service to God that they think that's what they need to do. Well, friends, the action is not correct because God's already done that work. But they're still motivated in a good way. So what the Lord is here saying is, He says, look, not only do I do things higher than you do, and my actions are better than yours, but before you get there, my motivation, my thoughts about it, the way I process it, it's higher than you. It's higher than heaven is above the earth. And so let's get lost for a little while in the ways and the thoughts of God. To begin with, when you consider God, when you consider who He is, let's consider, first and foremost, what He is. John tells us in 1 John chapter 4 and verse 9, very simple expression. He says, God is love. Now, you will hear people say that. You'll hear people say God is love. But most of the time, people don't truly understand what that means, and we don't either. Because, one, we don't truly grasp all that God is, and two, we don't fully have a handle on what love's all about. We think we do sometimes, but we don't. Consider God being love. If I was to ask you to explain, what does that mean, that God is love, how would you frame that? What would be your reference point? Here was John's reference point, two verses later. 1 John 4, verse 11, he says, herein is love. You want to know where this all stems from? Here's love. Herein is love, not that we love God, but that He loved us and gave His only begotten Son for us. Here, friends, is the heart of love. It's not anything we've done towards God. It isn't any way in which we have worked to show our affection or to please Him. Here's what love really is, that God loved us and that He gave His only begotten Son for us. We cannot comprehend what it's like. We cannot understand what it's like that before time even began, God would have an affection and have a love and set it upon a group of people that He knew good and well they were going to be ruined. He knew good and well they were going to be worthless. He knew good and well every single black mark that each one of us are going to commit. And yet, even knowing that, He willingly sacrificed His Son. And that was done legally at Calvary 2,000 years ago when His Son died and poured out His love upon us, and it was shed abroad unto us. Friends, we can't comprehend and understand the motivation for that. I've told you before that if I only had one child, I would really have to consider how tough this is. But I have four children.
of more poor children. I've got two sons. You could make a case that if I gave one of them up, I still got children. But friends, even with the four children that I have, I ain't giving any one of them up. That's just me. I mean, I hope y'all don't think bad of me, but I ain't giving them up. And it ain't just because I ain't going to give them up for you. I certainly wouldn't give up my children for a murderer on death row, would you? I wouldn't. I wouldn't give up mine for a person whose heart was cold and black. Now, I might willingly give my life, for you. I certainly would for my wife or for my children, and I trust for those that I love, I would be willing to lay down my life for my brethren, as we're commanded to do in Scripture. But friends, there's a big difference between laying down my life for you and having one of my children lay down their life for you. Herein is love. Not that we love God, but that He loved us, and that He gave His only begotten Son for us. That's something that is higher than we can possibly imagine. Now, I wonder if this motivation was due to something God thought He would get out of it. You know, a lot of times our motivation for doing something is, what will we get in return? I mean, I'll be honest. When I put my money that I have earned into the hands of investors, whether it's a bank or whether it's some other group, I don't put it in their hands and hoping to come back in 20 years and they say, well, you know, we tried, but there just wasn't a whole lot to be done. Well, we tried, but you ain't got nothing left. I promise you that's not the reason why I put my money into retirement. It's not why I put my money in investment portfolios. I'm looking for something on the other side of it. Don't y'all put your money back for the same reason? Okay. I mean, that's the reason I put my money back. Well, friends, God didn't do this to see what He'd get out of it. God knew exactly what we were, and He knew exactly what we were going to get out, what He was going to get out of it. But yet, friends, He has love that is not based upon what He's going to receive in return. It's not based on, friends, what it's going to benefit Him. Because all He gets in return is us, and all He gets is our presence with Him in His home. That's not a whole lot of return on investment, and yet God has a motivation for us that it goes beyond anything that I could possibly imagine. Why would He love somebody like me? Why would He love somebody like you? It blows my mind that somebody like us would have that kind of care and affection by God. And yet He did. He had it set upon us, as He tells Jeremiah in Jeremiah 31 and verse 3. He says, yea, I have loved thee with an everlasting love. Therefore, with loving kindness have I drawn thee. We don't have the capacity to understand how God can think this way. We don't have the capacity to understand how God would act this way. And yet I certify to you, as I do to all saints, that we have met here together today to adore one who has done things that we can't comprehend because we adore Him for who He is and what He is and how He has done great things unto us. We don't have the ability to describe God. We don't have the ability to describe love, much less God's love for His people. So God is love. And that love is manifested mostly, or most manifestly, in Him sending His Son for us. Now, consider something else that God is. We're told in 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13, something else God is. This gets to His character and His integrity. We're told in 1 Corinthians 10 and 13, it says, there is no temptation taken you but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, and He will not suffer you to be tempted above that which you are able, but will with the temptation also make a way to escape that you may be able to bear it. Here, we're told that God isn't just love. We're here told God is faithful. That word faithful doesn't mean full of faith necessarily. It can mean that, but the word faithful here means honest, upright, person of integrity. Somebody who is the same, no matter the circumstance. And here's something that we struggle with. You know, even the best person on the worst day can behave like a bad individual. And even the worst individual on a good day or on the best day can behave like a fairly decent person. That's the kind of the way we are. Circumstances dictate so much of who we are and how we act and how we interact with one another. But here, Paul says, God is faithful. I was having a conversation with a man at work a couple weeks ago. He's a very interesting person. He's one who I struggle sometimes to know what it is. I'm not sure he knows what he personally thinks at the time. It changes all the time. It's like moving goalposts. It's like trying to score a touchdown, and every time you look up, you still got 100 yards to go. So I was having this discussion with him. I'm sorry, when you don't have football to watch, you still have analogies you want to use. So anyway, I was having this discussion with him, and he said, I refuse to believe or serve a God that would just kill somebody. And I said, well, let me ask you this. Do you serve under a government that legally has the authority to put somebody to death? And he said, yes. I said, well, if you serve under a government, and he works for the base, I said, you work for this government who legally can put somebody to death, why would you argue that the King of this universe, the King of kings and the Lord of lords, does not have the right to do what he will with his own as he sees fit as king? If you want him in that, I will. He can do as he sees fit because he is king. But here's the beautiful thing about our king. This king is unlike any other king. He's unlike any other ruler. You know why? Because this king is faithful. He's upright. Circumstances don't affect him. You know, when you wake up and you're having a bad day and your thoughts are far astray and gone astray from him, his thoughts are still upon you. When you wake up and you're not having the best of days and your ways are moving in a way contrary to God, his ways are still directed towards you. I love what we're told about him in Deuteronomy 32. Moses, when recapping God's interactions with his people, recapping all their travels from Egypt all the way to Canaan's land, he is getting to the end of Deuteronomy and he gives this grand declaration of God, who he is and what he's done. And in verse 4 of Deuteronomy 32, Moses writes, he is the rock. His work is perfect. A God of truth and without iniquity, just and holy is he. I tell you, that's a pretty grand summation of God's character, of God's integrity, and who he is. We can't comprehend what it's like to be somebody who is the same, no matter what is going on around me. I mean, a lot of us like to say, well, things don't affect me. I mean, I'm one of these people who, you know, I like to tell others that I've got pretty thick skin, and I trust that I do. But friends, it's easy, even when we don't think it is, it's easy for things to get us down. It's easy for things to rile us up. It's easy for things to pump us up in a good way or let the air out in a bad way. I mean, that's just life. And no matter how good you are, there are times when things are going to back up on you, emotions are going to swell, and you're going to do things, say things, think upon things, and act in a way that's just not good for the time. God never has that problem. He never gets anything wrong. His work is perfect. Why is it perfect? Because he's faithful. He is without iniquity. He is without spot. He's without blemish. He never has a thought that's tainted with sin. But more than that, he never has a thought that's tainted with worry. He never has a thought that's tinged with doubt. Have you ever made a decision and you said, I am fully persuaded that this is exactly the way it is. And then 5 minutes later you're going, I see some of y'all do the same thing. I'll say, I am perfectly convinced that this is, well, maybe. God doesn't struggle with that. When God has a thought, when God has a motivation, there's no doubt in the back of his mind. There's no worry in this part of his brain. When God has a thought, when he has a motivation, it is perfect, it is just, it is upright, it is holy. And friends, because of that, he is faithful. Aren't you glad in 2020 when you can't count on anything else? Aren't you glad you can still count on God to be just like he was in 2019? Aren't you glad that even though governments come and go, aren't you glad that even though, you know, influences, mothers and fathers come and go, spouses come and go, aren't you glad that in this changing world in which we live, aren't you glad he doesn't change? Aren't you glad he's still as faithful now as he was 2,000 years ago? I tell you, it didn't say God was faithful. It doesn't say God will be faithful. It says God is faithful all the time, every time he is faithful. God of truth, without iniquity, just and holy is he. His work is perfect, and he's the rock. Because of that, friends, his character, his reputation, and everything about it, everything that goes into it, and everything that comes out of it is higher than we can possibly imagine. It's not tinged with any of the doubt that we feel. It's not tinged with any of the remorse that we feel over getting something wrong. He is so far above us in that regard that we can't even comprehend the havoc. This, every thought he has, every action he has, there's nothing he needs to reassess. There's nothing he needs to reframe. You know, one of the things that happens at work is whenever we're done with a certain meeting, whoever it is leading that meeting, whether it's a civilian or a military personnel, they'll always have what they call reattacks. They'll say, around the room, any reattacks anybody wants to bring out? And what they're saying is, because of the conversation, everything that's flowed out, any of you have anything else additional to add that you thought of? Or do you want to sort of reframe, sort of rephrase what you presented because now with some more information, you realize maybe don't have that exactly right, I need to go back and look at it. You know, God doesn't have to reattack anything. God doesn't have to reassess anything. And God's not coming back the second time to get the job done that he didn't get done the first time. He's coming back the second time to show he already got the job done the first time. He's not coming back to give anybody a second chance because he didn't come to give anybody a chance. He's coming back to get his people who, by his purpose, he's already saved. God is not reattacking anything. And I assure you this morning that God's not up in heaven going, man, 2020 has just been a bull of a year. My goodness. I mean, God knew this was coming, and God saw all this was going to happen, and God doesn't have to reassess and reattack what he's going to do. He is faithful. So God is love. God is faithful. So we have a measure of his love, and we have a measure of his integrity. We have a measure of not only his affection, but also of his character. What else could someone possibly say if someone, let's say someone was to come at you, and they were to come at you and say that your motivation wasn't exactly right, or your ways and your actions aren't exactly right. First thing they might attack is they might attack your affection, your motives, your sympathy, your charity. And if you prove that you're a loving person, and we prove that God is a loving person, far more than we could imagine, then they say, well, I understand that, but are you a person of integrity? Can we trust that you are someone who honors what you say you're going to do? Well, we've proven God's integrity. What else can someone then charge you with? Well, you just don't. I mean, you've got a good heart. And yes, you're a good person, but you just don't know what I know. You just don't know everything about this. You ever heard somebody who is being, I don't know, counseled with or challenged about a position, and their statement, it's like a Trump statement, is, well, you don't know, you're not in my shoes, you just don't know what I'm going through. Let me tell you something, friends. There are a lot of people in this world who are living in situations that they feel are unique to them. But remember what 1 Corinthians 10:13 started with? It started with this. There is no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. We need to understand, no matter what is happening in the world, no matter what anybody else is saying in the world, one of the worst statements that someone can make to prove their position is, well, you just don't know what it's like to be me. What is that really saying? That I have to know what it's like to be you, to be able to reason with you and counsel with you about what you're going through. You know, if somebody is struggling because they've been unfaithful to their spouse, I don't feel the need to go out and be unfaithful to my wife just so I can relate to them, just so we can have a conversation. Do you understand what I'm saying? Do you? All right. I mean, I don't need to walk in somebody's shoes to be able to have a conversation about it. You know why? Because, friends, I don't have to have the experience to be able to have the conversation, because all the experience and the knowledge we need is right here. The Bible tells us in Psalm 147 and verse 5 about God's knowledge. It says that His understanding is infinite. Now, infinite is an interesting word. It's a concept that I can tell you what it is, but I don't understand it. So let's just get lost for a minute in infinite. The word infinity literally means, it's a mathematical term, that literally means it goes forever this way, and it goes forever this way. Now, I'll be honest with you. It's starting right now on September the 6th, September the 6th, 2020, you speak of forever from September the 6th, 2020, I kind of understand that. All right? I don't truly understand, but I kind of do. But if you start in September 6th, 2020, and you go forever backwards, I am just as fried upstairs as you can possibly imagine. My brain is just short-circuited. You know why? We can't comprehend without end this way. Because if there's no end this way, our mind says, well, how did we ever get to now? Right? If it goes on forever this way, how did I ever get here? And yet we're told that God is without beginning of days, and He's without end of line. His understanding is infinite. It goes forever that way, it goes forever that way, and there's nothing that happens that God cannot say, well, I just didn't see that coming. God can always say, I not only see that, I not only understand that, I knew that was coming, and I was already prepared, if you want to say it that way, I already knew what I was going to do in response to it. God does not struggle like we do with understanding. Have you struggled in the last 5 or 6 months to know what's real and what's not? Have you struggled to know with what you're being told, whether it's true or not? I'm sure all of us have. Especially when what you're told this week might change in 2 weeks. It's tough. But friends, God doesn't struggle like that. He doesn't have the limitations that we do. He not only knows, the psalmist says He understands everything. His understanding is infinite. Now that by itself would be enough. If God had infinite understanding, that would be enough. But you know, nobody can actually look at God and give the same claim that they give today to finish or to kill a conversation. Well, you just don't know. You just haven't seen. You just haven't experienced. You just haven't understood what it's like to be me. I tell you, friends, God, an infinite God, a loving God, a faithful God, He's more than all that. As we mentioned yesterday, 2,000 years ago, He became a man as well. And as a man, He experienced everything that we could possibly experience with the exception of sin itself. He does not know what it's like to be a sinner. But I tell you this, He understands the penalty of sin. He understands the bitterness of sin. He understands the weight and the guilt of sin. Not because He's committed it, but because all my sins were laid upon Him. Because all of my bitterness and all of my anger and all of my strife and all that I am that is a stench before His Father was laid upon Him. And He bore that to the very bitter end. But on top of all that, friends, to the point He was born into this world, at the time that He got to that point, He experienced what it was like to be one of us. He experienced what it was like to tread this low ground of sin and sorrow the way that we do. Paul tells us in Hebrews 4:15, we have not a high priest which cannot be touched with the feelings of our infirmities, but was in all points tempted like as we are, yet without sin. I tell you, friends, when you consider Him, and I may not know what you're going through. I may not know what it's like to have lived and walked in your shoes. But I tell you, He has. Not only because He lived 2,000 years ago, because He's living it right here today with you. He goes with you. He walks with you. His Spirit is in your heart. And He knows what it's like to be where you are. He knows what it's like. He even knows what it's like when He's going with you and you're not going with Him. Now, I know that probably doesn't sound like it makes sense, but it does. Because you can be going with somebody and they're not going with you. I'll give you a very, very simple analogy that kind of pokes fun at me. Not get me in trouble. But there was a girl I wanted to date in college. And I was tenacious about it. By the way, she's not the one sitting back there. And I was really after her. Because I really wanted to go with her. And she finally relented to go on a date with me. And when the date was over, she agreed because I wouldn't let up to go on a second date with me. But then she got smart. When the second date came around, she got sick. Now, I can tell you that we went together on a date. But in point of fact, I went with her. She didn't really go with me. Y'all understand where I'm coming from? All right. You know, no matter what our mindset is, no matter what our affection is, God goes with us. We just don't always go with Him in return. Now consider God going with us. That means that no matter where you are, whether it's seen or unseen, whether you think it's hidden or not, God's there, God's with you, and God's walking and going with you. David says in Psalm 139, he says, "Where shall I go to flee from thy presence? For if I ascend up into heaven, behold, thou art there. If I make my bed in hell, behold, thou art there. If I should take the four winds and go to the uttermost part of the earth, he said, thy spirit is ever with me. David said, there's nowhere I can go that you're not already there. There's nowhere I can be that you haven't already trodden that, and you go there when I go. You know, he even goes on later in Psalm 139 to say this. He said, if I should say, the darkness shall cover me, he says, thine eye can see, because dark and light are both alike unto thee. He doesn't have any trouble seeing in the dark any more than he does during the daytime. He can see us, he knows, and he goes with us. And as such, he's a high priest that knows what it's like to walk here himself. He knows what it's like by his spirit to go here with us. And he knows the full weight and the full ramifications of sin as they're all laid upon him. He is one who, I can assure you, his understanding is infinite. You can't think of a particular piece of ground that he's not acquainted with, that he doesn't have knowledge of, that he's not fully understanding of all that goes. So, God has perfect love in motivation and in application. God has perfect integrity and faithfulness, both in motivation and application. And God has perfect knowledge, both in motivation and in application. God's thoughts and God's ways are higher than ours. They're not ours. They're as high as the heaven is above the earth. So high are his ways above ours and his thoughts and our thoughts. So, if you can't charge somebody with their affection, if you can't charge somebody with their integrity, if you can't charge somebody with their knowledge, what is the only piece of ground left in which somebody would then charge somebody? You know, and this one doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense, because if somebody has perfect love, perfect integrity, and perfect knowledge, it doesn't seem like there's anything left. But you know, one of the ones that we so often say is one of our defenses of how we think and how we operate, well, they didn't do that the way I'd have done it. You ever heard somebody say that? Well, that's not how I'd have handled it. You know, one of the things that God knows that we don't, one of the things that God does that we don't, is that God understands there's not always the same way, the same operation of doing the same thing. You know, sometimes when God operates universally. I'll give you an example. When he does the new birth, and he quickens somebody from nature's darkness into divine life, that operation is the same across the board. As the wind bloweth where it listeth, thou hearest the sound thereof, but canst not tell whence it cometh, or whither it goeth, so is everyone that is born of the Spirit. So God does sometimes do things the same across the board. But let me ask you this. Does God always reveal things in the same way, to the same type of people, in the same situation, in the same circumstance? No. Jesus, when praying to his Father in Matthew 11:25, said, O Father, Lord of heaven and earth, I thank thee that thou hast hid these things from the wise and the prudent, and hast revealed them unto babes. Now, it would make sense, would it not, for God to reveal things of a very special nature to people in positions of authority who could then pass it down and teach it to others under them. That would make sense, right? But sometimes God bypasses teachers. Sometimes he bypasses the wise and the prudent. Sometimes he bypasses the mighty and the noble of this world and reveals it to the weak, to the despondent, to the cast down. As he says in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, he says, not many wise, not many mighty, not many noble after the flesh are called, but God has revealed them unto the despised of this world, to the poor of this world. God doesn't operate in a way like man would. God doesn't do things the way man thinks they ought to be done, and thank God he doesn't. Thank God he doesn't act like we act. Thank God he doesn't do it like we want. You know, sometimes God answers prayer just like that. Sometimes he doesn't. You know, there's times whenever we think, well, God, why haven't you already answered my prayer? But you know what's funny about it? When he answers prayer just like that, we start second-guessing it. Remember what happened there in Acts 12? Whenever Herod had put James, the brother of John, to death with the sword. And he was determined to kill Peter also. And the whole church was met together, praying that Peter would be delivered. An angel comes into the prison, releases Peter from prison. Even Peter doesn't believe it at first. But once he finally gets outside the city, realizes this is not a vision, this is really happening. So he immediately goes to the house where the church is making prayer for, starts knocking at the gate, and a little girl named Rhoda says, "Who is it?" "It's Peter." "No, really, who is it?" "It's Peter." So she gets excited. She comes inside. "Peter's outside." "No, he's not." "Yes, he is." "No, he's not." "Well, don't you hear somebody knocking?" "Well, if somebody's knocking, maybe it's his ghost." What would it be like if we were to all meet together here this evening, afternoon, evening, and have a prayer meeting for rain? And while we're praying, somebody goes outside and says, "Hey, y'all, it's raining outside." Would it make a whole lot of sense for us to say, "No, it's not"? Would it make a whole lot of sense if we heard the rain pounding down on the roof to say, "That's got to be hail"? Does that make any sense? No. And yet, here God has answered prayer just like that, and they start second-guessing it. You know, I can comment on this, but I've lived Acts 12. I don't know about you, but I have. I've actually prayed, and before I got up off my knees, the answer had come, the remedy had come, the solution had come. And because my thoughts are not his thoughts, what happened? There was a little bit of doubt in the back of my mind. I said, "I wonder if this is really real. I wonder if this is really how it's happening. Aren't you glad that God in his ways doesn't do what we would do? God doesn't answer prayer the way we would. God doesn't handle matters the way we would. There's times when I look at this world in which I live, and I wonder, friends, why God hadn't already done something about it. Why God hadn't just wiped some things out. I tell you, unlike my coworker, I don't struggle with the fact that God has the ability to kill people. I don't struggle with the fact that God has actually smitten people and put them to death. That doesn't bother me. But I tell you what does bother me. What does bother me is I wonder sometimes why he hadn't done it. How about you? I wonder sometimes why these things continue on and continue on and continue on. I wonder, friends, why God in his infinite wisdom and his understanding and his fullness of love and his faithfulness to this world and to his people, why God hasn't done something about certain things yet. Like those souls in Revelation chapter 6 who've been beheaded, who were beneath the throne of God, that John witnessed and saw them crying out and saying, "How long, O Lord? How long wilt thou not avenge our blood upon this earth?" Remember what the Lord told Cain when he asked Cain where his brother Abel was, and Cain said he didn't know. He said, "Does not thy brother's blood cry unto me from the ground?" He said, "Your brother is crying unto me, his blood being spilled upon this earth. He's crying for vengeance. He's crying for justice. He's crying for something to be done about it." Do you ever in your prayer closet cry to God to do something about the struggles and the problems that we have in this whole world? Do you ever wonder why it is that it seems that God has tarried in his coming? Why God seems to have delayed his actions on certain things? I tell you, friends, there are some things that are just beyond us to understand. But here's one thing that I have to go back to and I have to hold on to, because it helps me when I'm getting lost in who God is and how God acts and how God operates. It does me good to remember that the Lord, not only in his love, not only in his knowledge, not only in his faithfulness, God is also not like us in his long-suffering. God's long-suffering is magnificent. You know, we sometimes call something long-suffering, and it's not. You ever had something that you didn't really want to deal with? Just didn't really want to think about it? Didn't want to have to do anything about it? And you said, "Well, I'll suffer with that." Is that long-suffering? No. I hate to burst your bubble. I'll burst mine too. That's not long-suffering. That's laziness. If it's something we don't want to do and we say we'll suffer with it, that's just lazy. I got one honest person over there. Let me tell you something, friends. God is not in heaven and he's not being lazy right now. God's not in heaven saying, "Well, you know what, I really don't want to deal with that, so I'll just suffer with it." Every time God's long-suffering, there's a reason. There's a purpose for that long-suffering. And I'm thankful to tell you that while I don't understand sometimes God's long-suffering, I do, by Scripture, know why. In his long-suffering, this world still stands today. That long-suffering, we're told in 2 Peter chapter 3, in verse 17, is because of one thing, and one thing only, salvation. Peter says, account the long-suffering of God as salvation. Think about life, what you've heard of it, 1,000 years ago. 1,000 years ago, during what they called the Dark Ages, when it just seemed like corruption was on every hand, followed a few years later by the Black Plague that swept over the entire world and just killed millions of people. What if, during that period, God said, that's it, done with it, it's over. None of us would have ever had an existence. We would have perished not having had an existence, nor having salvation. Consider what you know of life 500 years ago. 500 years ago, there was a lot of oppression. There was a lot of strife. There was what was known as colonialism and imperialism, as people were trying to exert their will on other people. Modern empires were trying to be established and sustained. And Christians in different parts of the world found themselves under great attack and probably mourned at the suffering and the persecution they were under. What if God had said then, you know what, my people have suffered enough, I'm not going to let them suffer anymore. It's over. We still wouldn't have existed. I don't think, as far as I know, the oldest person we've got in this area lives just down the road. She's 100 now. But in 1918, I know I wasn't alive, I'm pretty sure you weren't either. What if, in the first major worldwide struggle that they call the World War, followed by this major epidemic, what if the Lord just said, you know what, the suffering's been too much, and friends, if you ever studied warfare, which I have, World War I was a horrible time. Because it was the first time in human history that I can recall where to such a degree, weaponry had outstripped medicine. And the weapons they were using, they didn't have the medicine to counteract. They didn't have the ways in which to, you know, attack the things that were happening. People got gassed. People got hit with stuff that there was just no remedy for. It was horrible. People lived disfigured, dismembered, and many other things for the rest of their life. After seeing that kind of destruction, millions dead, seeing a plague, millions dead, what if the Lord said, I'm done with it. It's over. Still none of us would have had an existence. Now I'm going to get to some of y'all in here, but I'm still not going to get to myself. What if during the roaring, violent 60s, when counterculture was on the rise, and people were going astray from God, and people were questioning everything that had ever been taught, including God's very own existence, what if God had said, this is it, it's over, I'm done with all this. Some of you would have been alive, but I wouldn't have. I wasn't alive yet. And friends, even today, in September the 6th of 2020, what if God today said, I'm done with it, it's over, it's history, it's all going to end right now. Friends, if that happened, there are still God's children who have not been born into this world, and more importantly, born again by His Spirit, who would have perished not having any existence. I tell you, friends, God has suffered long with this old world. God has suffered long with His church. God has suffered long with me as an individual. God has suffered long with all of us. And why does He do it? I tell you, the first and foremost reason why He does it is salvation. The salvation of His people, that when God comes the second time without sin unto salvation, it will be the right time, the perfect time, the exact right moment, because every single heir of grace will have had an existence, been born again by His Spirit, and go to be with Him in heaven forever and for all eternity. I tell you, there's a lot about God I don't understand. And I don't understand everything I just preached to you this morning. But I'm glad to know that the God I serve, when I can't figure it out, He can and He has. That when I don't walk in it like I should, He can and He has. And when I don't express it the way that I should, He can and He has. And more than that, when I feel like I can't bear with it for another moment, He can and He has. Thank God His thoughts are not our thoughts. Thank God His ways are not our ways. Thank God it's as high as heaven is above earth. But one day I'm looking forward to putting my eyes on Him, beholding His face in righteousness and being satisfied in my way with His likeness. And on that day, I'll know His thoughts. I'll know His ways. I'll know what it is that makes Him do and motivates Him to do the things that He does. And on that day, I'll be able to adore Him for all He is and for all that He's done. Until that day, may we bow in submission and humility to the King of this universe, the Creator of our soul, to the Savior of who we are. May we bow in submission to Him, thanking Him that He's that high above us, that even though it's outside of our control, it's never outside of His. May we thank God that He is who He is and He's done what He's done for us as people. And in so doing, may we be a shining light in the world in which we live. I hope these things have been a blessing unto you. I hope we've gotten lost together. I hope you didn't just get lost. I hope we've gotten lost together in the beauty and the glory of who God is. If you have, you give Him all the praise, honor, and glory. If you've just been lost this morning, you let it to my charge. That's my fault, not His. May the Lord bless you, my friend.